Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to the people out in California that might be on. Welcome to this month's webinar for our Venture Law Meetup Series. This month we're discussing business valuation basics for early stage companies with Sean Sari from Skoda Minotti, which is a CPA firm located in Cleveland, Ohio. Sean focuses his practice in the valuation area, and I'll let him introduce himself further. Just a quick note for those of you who haven't met me before. So I'm of counsel in the corporate department of Squire Patton Boggs. Now, I've spent most of my career working with startup companies, whether as an engineer at a startup company early on in my career, and then moving into counseling startup companies through tech transfer departments and then ultimately in a law firm with a little furlough of about 6 years at a startup company as their first and only in-house counsel. And so the topics around kind of how we can advise startup companies is very close to my heart in the work that I do every day. So I'll let Sean introduce himself as well.
Sure. Thanks, Leah, for having me on today. Certainly appreciate it. So as Leah mentioned, my name's Sean Sari. I'm with the firm Skoda Minotti, CPA and business advisory firm based out of Cleveland, Ohio, with offices also in Akron and Tampa. But fortunately now with kind of the way that the world is and how everything is digitized, we're able to kind of do work wherever it may be. So it makes it somewhat convenient. As Leah mentioned, we're going to spend our hour today talking about valuation and specifically how valuation impacts early stage companies. We had a great discussion last Friday, and we have some questions that we got then that we can work into the presentation today to hopefully give you some additional insight. And I think there should be a little bit here for kind of everyone's experience level, whether you're new to this or this is something you've been doing for years. I think there should hopefully be a couple takeaways that you'll get regardless. So, Leah, if you want to maybe give us the intro to the sponsors and a thank you there.
Absolutely. And just a quick note to everyone on the line, if you have any questions, please do ask them. The way the questions work on the webinar, though, is that instead of saying them, you type them, and we can see them in front of us. So we'll be happy to read your question out loud and respond to it if you have anything. I guess going on to what Sean had mentioned, the co-sponsors, so we don't do this alone, and we couldn't. We actually have 10 institutions that help put this program on. And just as you see on the slide deck in front of you, the assortment of institutions that are involved in this program. So, thank you to all of them. Special thank you to Skoda Minotti, as they're here with us today.
All right, so what are we looking to accomplish today? And I would tell you there are two broad concepts that we hope when we're done with the hour that you feel a little bit more comfortable with and that you're more familiar with. And the first of those is just having an understanding and being able to recognize the different methods that are typically used to value a business or an ownership interest. There are courses you can take on valuation that are weeks long. So we're not certainly going to be able to go through all the details to teach you how it's done, but at least to give you somewhat of a working knowledge as to what are the methods that are typically used, what are some of the highlights, the pros, the cons of each of them. And there's also a case study that I believe is distributed as part of our call today. We're not going to go through it in detail because we're going to spend more time talking about some of the early stage concepts, but that handout is meant to really just give you an idea as to what does evaluation look like and how are those methods applied. So that's one of our two goals. And the second goal is to really hone in on some of the factors that are unique to early stage companies. It really is somewhat of a different world when we start talking about early stage companies versus mature companies from a value perspective. And we're going to talk about what are some of those differences, why are early stage companies unique, and what are some of the specifics that we need to consider when looking at companies that are either pre-revenue or very early on in their development. So we'll have a couple of quotes throughout. I'm a big quote person. So, you know, the first quote there from Henry David Thoreau that in the long run, men hit only what they aim at. So those are the two things that we're really aiming for today. And hopefully, you know, when we wrap things up, we'll all feel like we've made some progress there. So the agenda and what we're specifically going to cover, number one, we're just going to talk about some valuation basics and laying the foundation for how evaluation is prepared, some of the key terms that are very relevant, and some of the areas where we see maybe some disconnects or misunderstandings to try to get everybody on the same page as far as the basics. Again, as I mentioned, we're not necessarily going to go into detail on the case study, but you're going to have that for your files. But we are going to talk about the different valuation approaches at a high level, give you an understanding as to how do those work. We're going to spend some time talking about control and marketability considerations. Now, those topics may ring a bell for some. They may be, you know, completely foreign to others. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what that means and how those two concepts can impact value, particularly for privately held companies. And then we're going to wrap up talking about what are the early stage company considerations and what are the unique factors that need to be considered when we're looking at valuing that type of company. So before we start diving into the valuation basics, our quote of the day is from Charles Dudley Warner. He's an American writer who I have to confess I've never read anything the guy's written, but he has the best quote that I've been able to take up as far as valuation. But and he says that there's no such thing as an absolute value in this world. You can only estimate what a thing is worth to you. And that's so true in the world of valuation. And we typically say that valuation is about 80% science and 20% art. And what's interesting is when we talk about early stage companies, this quote is even truer, because with early stage companies, things are even more subjective from a value standpoint than they are with mature companies. When we're looking at an early stage company, I often liken it sometimes to the Wild West as far as, you know, determining value. And if we were to give the same set of facts of a company or a startup or an idea to 100 different individuals or investors, I can almost guarantee you're going to get back 100 different indications of value. Now, with a mature company, I would tell you those indications should be relatively close, and hopefully they cluster around, you know, some sort of a measure of central tendency, and we get, you know, an indication within a pretty tight range as to what a business might be worth. When we talk about early stage companies, value is so much in the eye of the beholder. And that you may have the same set of facts, and again, given to 100 different individuals or investors, I would expect that range of potential value in the eyes of those investors to be much wider. There are going to be individuals who look at earlier stage companies and say, hey, you know what, there's just too much risk here for me. I don't really assign any value to this company. And there are going to be others who are going to look at the idea and the potential market size and the likelihood of being able to capitalize and follow through on that idea or that concept, and they may be willing to put a significant value on it, even though there's a lot of execution risk in getting to that point. So with early stage companies, one of the things that we always tell clients is it's very, very subjective, and it is truly even much more so in the eye of the beholder as far as what is the value. From the standpoint, and we'll get into what are some of the reasons that early stage companies are valued. One of those reasons is for raising capital. And one of our pieces of advice is, you know, when it comes to valuing early stage companies, we always tend to advise clients that your time and your money is probably better spent rather than having someone like us value the business. Actually using that time and money, developing the projections and developing the story and the support behind the story as to how are those projections going to be attained, because that's ultimately what an investor is going to base their investment decision on and the sort of value that they assign to the company. Now, you could hire somebody like us to value the business, but an investor is going to look at it and say, well, that's great. That's what, you know, so-and-so thought the value was, but here's what I'm actually willing to invest based on, and here's the value that I assign to it. And they're assigning that value based on the story that they hear from the founders and the financial projections that are prepared and their expectation of those projections actually being able to be achieved. So it with earlier stage companies, it really, really is about the story and the expectations that are driving the value. Because again, especially with pre-revenue companies, you know, we don't have any history to look to give us an indication as to how this company might perform in the future. It is very much based on a number of different assumptions coming true. And the more that that story can be fleshed out as to how and why those milestones will be met, typically the better light the company will be portrayed into investors, and hopefully the lower risk that those investors will assign to the investment.
Right. Another key factor just to note is that reputation factor. Now, someone who's done a successful exit from a early stage company, in today's marketplace is more likely to get money for their next company. VCs take a lot of stock in serial entrepreneurs that are successful over and over again, and they give them value based on that.
Leah, that's a great point. And I think it just reemphasizes the fact of the story being so important, and that if you have someone who's shown that they can take an idea or a concept and effectively turn that into a business, you know, if they've done it before, it gives the investor some comfort that, hey, I think these people can do it again. You know, they've got a track record versus, you know, if you're doing it for the first time, you don't have that history to fall back on to kind of highlight for the potential investors. So they're likely going to see that as a little more risky and may look at the value differently as a result of that. That's a great point. So what are some of the basics as far as how companies are valued and some of the ground rules for valuing a business? And the first thing that I want to point out is this concept of standard of value. And the two that I really want to focus on are fair market value and then strategic or investment value. So when someone's taking a company to market, particularly if they're looking for an exit, owners are often thinking about a strategic or an investment value, someone who might be willing to pay a little bit more for the business because when we combine those two companies, maybe there are some synergies that we can unlock and create some additional value by combining these two companies together. That is very different from a fair market value. And a fair market value is determined under the construct of a hypothetical willing buyer and a hypothetical willing seller. And that's really the standard of value that's required in anything that's subject to IRS review. So if we have any sort of valuation that has a tax component to it, and we're going to spend some time talking about one of those areas, which is IRS code section 409A. We're going to talk about that in some detail later on today. And that relates to the value of the company in comparison to the strike prices of any options that are issued. And there are some very significant tax consequences there. From an IRS standpoint, they're looking at fair market value. So fair market value, I would tell you, is more of a financial value. What's this worth to a buyer who maybe isn't in the business already and is going to have to go through the same steps and take the same risk in order to take this idea to its end and bring it to fruition? versus a strategic buyer who may already be in the business, and this is more of plugging in maybe another piece to their business to help them grow, and they may already have a platform to better exploit the idea or the technology. So keep in mind, there are different perspectives as far as the standard of value, and it really determines the rules under which we're going to determine the value of the company.
Right, and just to interject a little bit on the fair market value, from a legal concept perspective, that's the value that we use in the foundational documents of the company. So if we're talking about stock options or restricted stock and a company has a right to buy back stock at a certain point that's vested, we always talk about fair market value, which is the lower of the values that Sean's mentioning. And that's just, if you're in the startup area and you're looking through your documents, that's what that means, not the value of, you know, big pharma buying little pharma, essentially.
Yep, that's spot on. You know, fair market value is always going to be something either equal to or most often less than that strategic value, because it's not going to include the, you know, the potential premium that a buyer may pay because, you know, they can better take advantage or exploit that idea than maybe the existing company might be able to. The second concept on here is this, the idea of, you know, is sales price equal to value? And I would tell you really the difference between those two is, you know, the sales price or the value at which a company raises money, that's an objective number. You know, that's based on a transaction. You know, we can look to the market to say, all right, here's what the market's telling us we're worth, and here's what we actually were able to raise money at, versus value, which, again, is very subjective. So we have to go through this subjective process of valuation when we're looking to raise money. But ultimately, it's, you know, when we have a sales price, that sets an objective marker then. And that objective marker becomes very important also from, you know, evaluation standpoint, again, for tax purposes, because if we're able to raise money at a certain value, you know, that's likely going to be something that the IRS is really going to look to and give a lot of weight and credibility to in assessing the value of the company for tax purposes. So keeping in mind that, well, again, it's a very subjective process. Once we have a value established, it becomes a very, very critical piece of information that's used in assessing the current value of the company, as well as setting a baseline as to where is the company going in the future and what sort of growth and value might there be going forward.
Right. And sorry to interject again. You know, I had meant to mention this in the introduction. You know, I see a number of names of people that I met out at JP Morgan Healthcare Week. And just to kind of bring back one of the conversations I had when I was out there that's really on point to what that sales value is I was meeting with one of my friends who's a CFO of a smaller pharmaceutical company that's currently raising money at a $240 million valuation. Now, their product is a functional cure for HIV, so that seems like a big market. And they're getting investment in at that price. And they're meeting with bankers out there, and they're, you know, talking about what numbers can we do an IPO at, and some of the numbers that, you know, they're throwing around, you know, in 5-6 months from now, going from a $240 million valuation to a $3 billion valuation. And in that 5 or 6 months, they don't expect to read out a clinical trial or have more data than they have today. So that's the subjectivity of the marketplace. Who's willing to pay what? You know, and I hope they can do a $3 billion IPO. But what did they create within their company, or what are they planning to create that changes the value?
Yep, that's very true. And you know, that it also, I think, Leah, highlights the importance of finding the right investor, and that you know, ideally, as a company is going to market and trying to raise capital, again, with the value being so subjective, you know, the founders or the current equity holders are so much better off by making sure that they approach a number of different potential investors to get their feedback on value. Because, again, the same set of facts, again, through different investors' perspectives and viewpoints, may produce wildly different values. And if the goal, the ultimate goal, is we want to raise money at the highest valuation possible, going through that process and talking to as many people as possible is really the best way to maximize the likelihood of that happening. And again, maybe there's somebody out there who, you know, they're raising at 200 million plus right now and they want to get to 3 billion. Maybe there's somebody who looks at it differently. But if they're, to me, and I think Leah, we had spoken about this as well, it certainly raises some eyebrows to say, well, what's going to change in the company over that 5 to 6 month time period that's going to create another, you know, close to $3 billion of value that isn't there today? And why weren't we able to raise that dollar amount today? So there's you know, a whole host of different factors that, that come into play. And again, it just further highlights the, you know, the subjectivity of value for these earlier stage companies. The third item from a basic standpoint that we want to spend a little bit of time on is just this concept of the type of value. And what I mean by that is when we talk in terms of value, very often owners are thinking of, well, what's the value to me as an owner if I were to sell? What are my proceeds? And that's really consistent with what we would call an equity value. You know, what's left over for the owners based on a particular sale price. Now, what's unique is a lot of times, particularly from a transaction standpoint, value is described not from an equity value perspective, but from what's called an enterprise value perspective, which is really the value of the company on a cash-free, debt-free basis. So we can calculate if we have an enterprise value, we can work our way down to an equity value, which is that bottom equation there where you see if we have an enterprise value, if we subtract the debt and we add the cash, it's going to bring us to an equity value. And where this becomes relevant is if you have a company that has some debt on the books, what the maybe the implied value of the company is based on a particular value, it may vary from what you take home at the end of the day in the way of proceeds. And, you know, for example, if we've got a company, and I'll talk in terms of an EBITDA multiple, because, you know, whenever we apply multiples such as an EBITDA multiple, very often it's based on an enterprise value. So let's say you've got your company, it's grown, and you're at a point where, you know, we've got some momentum and we're generating $1 million of EBITDA in a year. And that the typical multiple, again, I'm going to throw a number out. Let's just say it's 10 times based on the company or the industry. That $1 million of EBITDA equates to a $10 million value. But what we haven't taken into account yet is how much debt is on the books. And if we had that same company has, you know, $7 million of debt that's been incurred over the years to help fund the company and get it to where it is at that point in time, that $10 million needs to be reduced by the debt balance to figure out, well, what's left for the owners at the end of the day. And there, again, there can be a meaningful difference where in that example, the owner's only going home with $3 million, even though he or she may hear $10 million and think, oh, well, that's great. That's what I'm going home with. There can be some differences. And I'm actually going to flip ahead two slides and we're going to come back. But again, the best analogy that I can put together for this is thinking of it like the value of your home. And that the value of the house is really like the enterprise value of the company. And if, you know, we were to, let's say you have a home and you're going to list it for sale. Let's say, hey, we think this home's worth $300,000. Well, that's the value of the home regardless of how it's financed. Just like an enterprise value is the value of the business regardless of how it's financed. Then we've got the furnishings, which is, you know, the stuff inside. Normally you'd expect to keep that with you if you were selling the home. But there's still value associated with that. And that's really like the cash in the business. A lot of times the cash stays with the seller and isn't part of what the buyer is acquiring as part of the business in an exit. So that's the same idea as the furnishings here. And then, if we're selling the home for $300,000, typically there's going to be a mortgage there and there's going to be some debt component. And it's only after we subtract the debt from that value of the home that we figure out, well, what's left for me as an equity holder. And it's that same concept with a business where we've got our enterprise value, we've got the cash on hand, and then we've got, you know, how much of that is funded by debt. The remaining is going to be the equity. That kind of becomes our plug in this scenario. So it's probably one of the areas, if not maybe the number one area, where we see the most confusion and maybe crossed wires between investors / buyers and then the sellers or the pre-existing owners as far as, you know, what value are we talking about and what does that mean to the equity holders, and just making sure that everybody's talking the same language and everyone really has an understanding as to, all right, if we're talking about a value, what does it really mean for the owners at the end of the day? So why is valuation relevant for early stage companies? So we've already hinted at both of these. You know, the first is the fact that anytime that we're raising capital or if there's a potential exit, value is typically the, you know, one of the highest, if not maybe the number one issue on the list that both buyer and seller are very keyed in on. The second idea or the second issue from a valuation standpoint is compliance with IRS section 409A. And we're not going to throw out a whole bunch of IRS codes, but this is certainly one that you want to be aware of and you want to have, somewhat of a basic understanding of, because there are some pretty significant tax penalties if that code section is not followed. And we're going to go into this again in detail later on, but to give you a little bit of a sneak peek, IRS section 409A relates to the concept of the IRS not wanting companies to be able to give value or compensate employees without them picking up some sort of tax consequence or without there being some sort of taxable income. And where that comes into play with early stage companies, this is very, very common for early stage companies to issue stock options in lieu of compensation. So we don't have the cash, but we're going to give you options that you can buy some ownership in the company at a, what will hopefully be a much lower price than what the company is actually worth at the time you exercise. And what IRS Section 409A does is it tells companies that if you're going to issue options, that's great. What you can't do is you can't issue an option that has an exercise price or a strike price, which is basically the amount the employee would pay in order to get the share. So you can't have that exercise or strike price be lower than the fair market value of the underlying share or unit. So, for example, if we have a company and it's we've determined that the common shares are worth $10 a piece, we can't issue a stock option with an exercise price that's less than $10, or it's going to put that option in the money right away. And it would theoretically give the employee the ability to say, all right, well, great, I'm going to exercise my option, I'm going to get the share, and then I'm going to sell it, and on day one, I can have a profit. The IRS doesn't want that because they kind of view it as hiding compensation. So it becomes very important to make sure that the value of the company is documented correctly. And we'll get into what some of the repercussions are if those rules aren't followed. So what are the basic valuation approaches? And I would tell you there are really three approaches that drive valuation in any shape and form, whether it's for an early stage company, it's for a mature company, even if it's for real estate, it's really these same approaches. There are different applications. But whether it's an asset-based approach, an income-based approach, or a market-based approach, those are really the big three that we would look to as far as how do we value a company. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about rules of thumb and how do those play in and where are they useful and where can they be a little bit trickier to apply. So if we start with an asset-based approach, this is really what I would describe as a balance sheet approach. And what we would typically do is we'd look at the balance sheet of a company as of a particular date, and we'd say, all right, well, let's adjust all the assets to fair market value. So that means, we may have, assets on the books that maybe aren't recorded at the value of what they're worth. Maybe they've appreciated in value. Well, we would adjust those to what are they actually worth. And from a liability standpoint, we look at that and we say, all right, are all the liabilities there? Is there anything that the company may be on the hook for that isn't on the books that we need to take into account? And again, it's very much like a snapshot of a balance sheet as of a particular date. And we really see this as providing a floor value for the company. Typically an asset-based approach isn't going to be a great way to capture any intangible value or goodwill value with a company. So we see this as setting a floor value. The other two approaches that we'll talk about, an income-based approach and a market-based approach, both of those are going to be the methods that are going to capture that goodwill or intangible value. An asset-based approach isn't necessarily built for that. So we look at it, again, as giving us a floor value, and it's probably the most straightforward of all these analyses. Again, we're just taking a balance sheet as of a particular date and figuring out, if I were to sell all my assets, collect what's owed to me, and pay off what I owe to others, what am I left with at the end of the day? The downside of this method is it's probably not going to give us a great indication of value if we've got a healthy business, because again, it's not going to capture that goodwill or intangible value. And if you have a company that has certain fixed assets or has real estate, it may be necessary to get those appraised as well. So asset approach is one of three approaches that we would at least consider in the valuation of a company. The second approach is what's called an income approach. And you'll see there are a handful of different methodologies that are outlined there, but I would break them really into two buckets for you and say there are some income-based valuation approaches that look at history, and they look at history to give us some idea as to expectations for the future. So if we've got a more mature company, looking at history typically gives us a pretty good indication of the future. When we have an earlier stage company, though, or we have a company that expects meaningful growth going forward, it may be the history may be less of an indicator of the future for us then. And in that case, we're really going to want to rely on the projections of the company as far as developing an expectation for the income or the cash flow of that business going forward. And that's where, as I alluded to at the outset of the discussion today, that it's so important for early stage companies to have projections put together, to have the backup and the support for the assumptions that are made, and to have the story put together as to how and why does management think those projections are reasonable and achievable. Because that's what's driving the value in this income-based approach. So the more support that can be prepared to give the investors comfort that, hey, we think these are reasonable and achievable projections, typically the higher value that that's going to equate to. So the pluses of using this sort of approach, number one, this really allows us to get the most company-specific value. You know, as I mentioned, the projections are specific to the company that we're looking at, so it really is going to hone in on, well, what's this specific business worth? And it also allows us then to incorporate the impact of the projected growth of the business on the value. On the flip side, this is by far the most involved methodology because we've got to get the projections, we've got to assess the reasonableness, we've got to figure out the risk of achieving those projections. And also, when it comes to projections, it's not uncommon for there to be disagreements as to what's the likelihood of actually being able to achieve them. And typically, the existing ownership group or seller thinks those projections are very achievable, and buyers looking at them in with a different set of glasses on, and typically is challenging the reasonableness. So there may be some back and forth as far as even if we have projections, you know, what's the likelihood of actually being able to achieve those. And then the third approach that we would expect to see in any valuation of a company is what's called a market approach. And this really falls into two different buckets. One would be what's called a guideline transaction method. And that's where we would look to transactions in a given industry and looking at the sort of pricing multiples that those transactions indicate. And typically, that's going to be EBITDA and revenue multiples. We could also look to public companies and look at the prices at which they're trading and, again, determine what are the implied multiples by those prices and the company's underlying metrics and apply those multiples to our company. Now, the market approach, particularly with a pre-revenue company, it's really almost impossible to apply because we don't have any of those metrics that those multiples are based on that are really applicable for our company. You know, if we've got a pre-revenue company and we can't apply a revenue multiple, and if we don't have revenue, we don't have EBITDA as well. So for earlier stage companies, you know, the application of these two methods is typically something that, you know, is either much more difficult or that we can't do. And instead, we'd be looking at, well, what have been the prices at which, you know, recent capital raises have taken place for this business to the extent that there are any. So, again, there can be some pretty material limitations in applying the market approach for earlier stage companies. You know, when we can apply it on the plus side, you know, it allows us to really capture what are market conditions and, you know, what are the prices that are being paid in these industries. And it's typically pretty easy to explain and apply. You know, owners get the concept of, you know, taking some metric times a multiple gives me a value. It's not terribly complicated. You know, on the downside, we just need to take into account, one, that typically these multiples are giving us an enterprise value and not an equity value. So we need to make sure that we take into account the debt and the cash balances in order to figure out what's left for the equity owners. And then there are just certain industries where there's a lack of good data. I would tell you that tends to happen less and less now as these transaction databases continue to grow, but it still happens every once in a while. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, unlike an income approach, which we can apply in pretty much any situation. So we talked about the three main methodologies. You know, there's also this concept of a rule of thumb. And it, I would tell you a rule of thumb is really a derivation of a market approach. And, you know, there are certain industries where there aren't great rules of thumb, and there are others where, you know, there's really good, reliable rules of thumb that can be used. You know, it's very simple to apply. What's really important with a rule of thumb is when we're applying that to a company, making sure that whatever metric it's being applied to, you know, whether it's, say, number of subscribers or it's revenue or it's EBITDA, that we're really applying it to the right adjusted metric. So, for example, if we have, you know, somebody who says, you know, this industry company sell for, again, five times EBITDA, if that's our rule of thumb for the industry, what makes or breaks that analysis is, what EBITDA are we applying? The reported EBITDA of the company may be vastly different from what may be appropriate to use from a valuation standpoint if there are a bunch of non-recurring expenses in there, or if there are differences in maybe there are discretionary expenses of the owners that are included in there that aren't required to run the business, and making sure that those are accounted for. So, you know, while a rule of thumb may get you in the right ballpark, to me, it's still really important that whatever metric we're applying that rule of thumb to, that we're giving it the right level of thought and making sure that if there are some sort of adjustments that need to be considered, that those are being made. So that's the quick primer on valuation overall. We're going to shift gears and spend a couple minutes here just talking about control and marketability considerations. And where these come into play is, you know, the vast majority of early stage companies are privately held. And with privately held companies, there are some unique considerations that we need to take into account, particularly when an investor is either buying in or being redeemed and they don't have control of the company or control of the investment. What I mean by that is if we've got someone who's putting money in and or who's being bought out and they own less than typically 50% of the company, so they don't own enough to be able to direct the activities of the company unilaterally. To some degree, they're along for the ride. In that case, a control discount would typically apply. And what that does is it just reduces the value of the company to take into account the fact that up to that point, we may not have considered the impact of control on the value. And those control discounts typically are in the 10% plus or minus range. So if we had a value of $100 a share prior to this discount, after we apply a control discount, if it's applicable, we'd be down to $90 a share. So, I mean, a pretty meaningful impact for something that, again, we're just applying a percentage, but it needs to be taken into account. It's appropriate to consider, you know, when we're valuing an interest that doesn't have control of the business. What's even more impactful is when we talk about marketability considerations. And with a privately held company, you don't have the ability to convert that into cash like you do with a publicly traded investment. You know, you can call your broker or go to E-Trade, a couple clicks of the mouse, and you can convert shares into cash relatively easily, quickly, with very little risk. That's an entirely different world than privately held companies, where even if we have control of the company and we want to sell it, it's not going to happen tomorrow. We've got to take the company to market. We've got to go through due diligence. There are a lot of risks as far as does the company or the industry change over that time. So you can't convert an ownership interest in a privately held company to cash nearly as quickly as you can for a publicly traded company. And we need, again, to take that into account in how we value the company. So let's take, for example, if we've got an owner who has control of the business, owns more than 50% typically, and can control if the company's going to be taken to market and sold. If we're looking at a privately held company, there's still a discount that would typically apply there for the lack of marketability in the sense that you can't convert that value to cash today, and there's risk associated with that. And those discounts normally range from about 5 to 15% of value. Where things really can get significant is if we've got a non-controlling interest, so someone, again, who's just along for the ride, can't necessarily influence the business on their own. So let's say it's an investor who owns 1% or 5% or 10%. Those sort of investors and those values, the applicable discounts typically are in the 30 to 35% plus or minus range. So, you know, like we talked about before, if we have a $100 value before discounts and we've got a 10% control discount, that brings us down to $90. And if, let's say we've got a, you know, a 33% marketability discount, that takes our 90 down to $60. So what was 100 is now 60. That's a pretty significant difference. Now, these discounts are what typically come into play when we're valuing a company for tax purposes that the IRS is reviewing it under this fair market value concept. So when it comes to setting strike prices, it can actually be very helpful because it allows the, you know, the board and the owners in the business to set strike prices that are maybe a little bit lower than what they might otherwise think they could use once these discounts come into play, and maybe allow them to set up an incentive program that really gets employees excited because they see the likelihood or the potential of these options, you know, being in the money at some point and creating some value for them, and really, you know, creating that plan or developing an option plan that really functions along the way that the intent was. That we really want to incentivize our employees to think and act like owners.
If I can interrupt you for a moment, I have a question. So we're applying these discounts in the fair market value scenario, and where I use it most in my practice, it's in the options, but also is in, you know, granting the company a right to purchase back founder shares. We say if X, Y, and Z happens, the company has a right to buy the shares at fair market value. Is it the same analysis to get to the value?
So it would typically would be, and when it comes to the founder shares, then we've got to give some consideration to do they have control or not. And if that founder has control, then those discounts are going to be far, far lower than they might be in a scenario where the founder doesn't have control. So it's really this control concept that really drives the magnitude of the discounts. And, you know, anytime that we hear fair market value, you know, unless there's something in the agreement that would tell us otherwise, where we've certainly seen agreements drafted where it will say fair market value without consideration of any applicable discounts. And if that's the case, that those are the rules we'll follow. But if we don't hear to the contrary, if we see fair market value, I think any valuation expert is going to think, all right, well, discounts are going to apply. What's appropriate and applicable in this case?
Okay, that's really helpful because on my desk today is actually buying out a 15% shareholder where we have a 70% shareholder.
So certainly a scenario where that's very relevant. And what's interesting is, you know, there are arguments on either side of that because the selling shareholder may say, all right, well, I realize that a discount might be applicable if I was selling it to an unrelated third party. But I'm basically selling it back to the owner or for the benefit of the controlling owner. And, you know, why should you get a discount to buy me out when you're getting the full value of that because those discounts don't apply to you in the same degree? So really we see that as kind of a planning consideration at the outset or if any sort of buy-sell provisions are set up, whether it's part of the operating agreement or something separate as far as, you know, what are the rules that are going to govern transactions amongst the shareholders? And, you know, getting those rules and terms in line early on is certainly a better situation because, you know, later on, you know, people may be thinking more for their own best interests rather than, you know, early in the game when everybody's still getting along and everybody's on the same page still. So, we've hopefully laid some of the groundwork as far as valuation, and we want to spend a little bit of time talking about, well, what specifically should you keep in mind that's unique to early stage companies? And, you know, there are a handful of different concepts that really impact how we value early stage companies. And, you know, the first is very often early stage companies have little to no revenue. A lot of times there are significant losses that are being generated. You know, it's not like these are profitable businesses yet. There may be little to no tangible assets that can be sold. And as a result, that makes the traditional valuation methods much more limited in their application and makes the valuation process from my perspective, much, much more subjective than you would have for an established company. And from an application standpoint, well, why is that relevant? And we talked a little bit earlier about 409A, and this is just the, you know, kind of the quick overview for you to reference if you want to throw this into your files. And the downside of not complying with this, and again, this is would be a scenario where a company has a stock option plan and it issues options that are in the money. So it's got a strike price that's less than the fair market value, which would allow the employee to buy the share and then theoretically sell it at a profit on day one. Well, what happens is not only will it trigger tax if this rule isn't followed. So if we've got a, you know, a $15 value share and you can exercise for $10, well, we've got some implied income there on day one that you're going to get taxed on at ordinary rates. And then there's also going to be a 20% penalty on top of that. So it's really, really onerous. And what's interesting is it's not really a penalty. There's no direct tax impact on the company. It's a tax impact to the recipient or the employee. And, you know, the intent of these option plans is to incentivize the employees. You know, and the last thing that you want to do then is create a whole bunch of tax headaches for them and, you know, accomplish the complete opposite as far as having a bunch of disgruntled and angry employees who are paying a bunch of extra tax that if these rules had been followed, wouldn't have been triggered. Lee, I know you had a really interesting comment the other day as far as, you know, while there may not be a direct impact on the company, just how it may impact maybe tangentially the company if 409A isn't complied with as far as kind of aligning the incentives.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, in my experience, we set up these stock option plans as a way to incentivize employees, especially in the early stage context. It's when the companies don't have cash on hand to give employees, you know, to, you know, pay them back for the extra good service or, you know, make them aligned with the company and, you know, working hard, helping to build something that's worth more value. So I guess, you know, my extra question today is, you know, given that's what they're used for, you know, I understand the 409A valuation, but it also comes in my mind with a dollar figure to pay an accountant like you to tell me what that number is. You know, what is the risk, though? You know, if the company doesn't have enough money to pay cash to their employees, they might not have enough money to pay for a 409A valuation.
Yep.
How do they make sure they don't screw things up?
Sure. No, that's a great point. And I would tell you from a practical standpoint, I mean, we haven't seen, you know, the 409A issue pushed all that much by the IRS. It's not to say that they don't do it, and it's not to say that they can't do it. But it certainly seems like, you know, there are areas of focus that are more important for them. You know, as far as how do you comply with this? There are really, and actually maybe unintentionally leads really well into kind of the next couple of slides here as far as, you know, how can you document that you're in compliance with this? And, you know, one of the approaches is you get an independent appraisal from someone like us. Now, obviously, that's going to be the more expensive of the options because you're paying an outside expert to come in and value the company. And I would tell you, the cost of that's going to vary depending on the complexity of the business and the last time that there was a capital raise. And the example I would give you would be if we've got a company that just raised money within the last couple of months and there aren't any significant changes in the business and it's all one class of stock, it's all common stock, say. In that case, I would argue, I don't even know if you necessarily need a valuation. You know, we're just going to look to what was the last capital raise. That's going to be our best indication of value, and it's not stale yet. It's still very relevant. So in that sort of scenario, you may not even need to get a valuation done. If you've got a scenario where we just raised money, which, again, that's a great data point to have, but let's say that the capital raise was a different class of stock. So instead of common stock, it was Series A preferred, and there was, you know, some unique rights and preferences. Maybe that preferred stock had a liquidation preference and maybe a participation preference. We'll talk about what those mean as well. That may mean that you know, we can rely on that capital raise value to come up with the value of the company, but we can't kind of use a one-for-one comparison. You know, options are typically issued on common stock. And if the most recent capital raise was a different class of stock, we can't just rely on that value. It's actually going to overstate the value of the company if we apply that to the company overall. And the example that I will typically use to keep things simple is, let's assume you raise $1 million for 10% of the company, and it's a Series A preferred share raise. Well, in that case, I would tell you the value of the company isn't $10 million. The value of the company is actually something less than that, because that $1 million that was invested, it wasn't common stock like all the other shares. It was preferred. And again, if they're getting a liquidation preference and a participation preference, that's, they're really getting more of the pie as a result of that. So if we have a scenario like that where we've got a capital raise, but it's of a different share class, there's some more work that would likely be done by an outside expert, but it's still far less than if we've got to value the company as a whole using the methods that we walk through. The potential third set of facts would be, well, let's say we have a company that hasn't raised money recently, but it is issuing options. Well, in that case, we might actually need to go through and value the company, and that's going to be the most involved, the most expensive, the most time-consuming. So depending on kind of the history of the company and when it has last raised money or when it plans to raise money, that really drives, you know, what sort of work needs to be done. As an alternative, you don't necessarily need to have an outside expert value the company, but it is one of these safe harbors that the IRS sets up to say, hey, if you get an outside expert to do it, we'll kind of give you the benefit of the doubt, and the burden of proof really gets shifted to the IRS to disprove that value. Doesn't mean that they can't still challenge it if it's off, but it puts the ball in their court, and it puts the company in a much stronger position. The other approach that puts the company in that same position of strength is what's called this illiquid startup inside valuation. And what that means is, let me flip over here, the company itself or the board can determine the value of the company for purposes of setting the strike price and to document compliance with 409A. There are a couple specific considerations that need to be followed, though. You know, one of which is it has to be a company that hasn't been in business for more than 10 years. Typically, that's not an issue with an early stage company. You know, it can't be a company that either plans on going public or selling within the next 90 to 180 days. Again, typically not an issue. The bigger hurdle is that the IRS requires that whoever's preparing the valuation, they say that they need to have at least 5 years of experience in valuing businesses, in investment banking, private equity, those sort of areas. And I would tell you, you know, the typical CPA isn't really qualified to value a company. You know, that's not part of the training that goes along with, you know, getting the CPA credential. It's kind of outside that sphere of experience and of skills. So it's very important that whoever's doing that analysis, that it's the right person, and hopefully that there's somebody that the company can lean on if they want to take this approach that would satisfy that requirement, because there can be personal liability if the person who's preparing that analysis isn't qualified, and certainly in that case, you want to make sure you got the right insurance policies in place. There's a little bit more risk there, but it can give you the same level of security as far as 409A compliance. One other thing I'll throw out from a 409A perspective that we kind of passed over, Leah, was a great question that kind of led us into some of these other slides. 409A valuations are typically good for 12 months. So the IRS actually has kind of a time limit on these, unless something happens that would indicate some material change in the company. So you raise new money, you reach a development milestone. Otherwise, you can use it for 12 months. So the good news is there that, you know, you can get it done once, and then you can issue options for a year without having to revalue the company. So it gives companies some flexibility of not having to go through this process every single time that options are issued, particularly if there's not a regular schedule that's followed and they're being issued as people, you know, come onto the company. As far as, you know, the methodology with valuing equity for 409A compliance and for earlier stage companies, the AICPA actually has some really good guidance out there. And there's a practice aid that they have that's listed here. So if you are hiring somebody to do the work, or if you're having somebody do it internally, this really sets the rules as far as what needs to be followed, what needs to be considered. And it does place a lot of weight on most recent capital raises. And we talked about the fact that, you know, if we have what's termed a complex capital structure, which means that we've got different classes of stock, those different preferences need to be taken into account in order to value the shares correctly. And this is really the first guidance that really gave good information on that concept and how it should be done. So it's something you really want to pay attention to. And it is these earlier stage companies that have complex capital structures. And it's kind of interesting. It's like, you know, the companies that have the fewest resources to kind of pay for all the headaches that go along with this are typically the companies that are required to have this sort of capital structure, because the people putting the money in, the venture capital firms, the angel investors, the private equity firms, they're requiring these sort of preferences in order to put money into the company. And the sort of preferences that we normally see, one, are liquidation preferences. So, you know, that investment and those investors, they're going to get their money out first before anybody else gets paid. There might be a preferred dividend, so some percentage of that investment amount is going to accrue to those investors on an annual basis. There may be conversion rights, where you can convert the preferred shares into common shares if that is more valuable. Or there may be participation rights. And I would tell you, this is probably the one with the most impact and maybe the least appreciated impact, because it can be so material. And what a participation right means is, what it allows the investor to do is they would get their liquidation preference back, they'd get their preferred dividends. On top of that, they would then share in any remaining proceeds as if they had converted to common. So they're kind of getting to go to the well twice. Not only are they getting their money back with a preferred return, but they're also sharing in some percentage of whatever's left over. And I think a lot of times founders don't necessarily realize the significant financial impact of that participation right and how much value it moves from the owners and puts to the investors when that sort of right is in place with any sort of investment. So when we have these complex capital structures and we have multiple classes of stock, when we're trying to comply with 409A, the methodologies that are used, and again, they're way too complex to get into today, but they're option-based. So we're looking at different option-based methodologies that allow us to take into account those different rights and preferences. And when we see these sort of complex capital structures, you know, some of the issues we've seen are, you know, if we have a preferred share raise and it's at $1 a share and it's a Series A and we're issuing common options. Well, if we set the strike price at $1 per share, I would almost guarantee that is well in excess of whatever the common shares are actually worth. And if the intent is we want to incentivize our employees to contribute to the business and help it to appreciate, well, it may be so far out of the money for them that they never reach that goal, even if the company appreciates by a ton over that time period. So it's really important to make sure that if you are setting strike prices for options, that you don't necessarily look just at, you know, what's the most recent capital raise price if it's a preferred share class, because it's not going to give you an apples to apples match. The fact of figuring out, well, what is the common equity worth? Again, I think very often, like, the headline prices that we see for some of these capital raises are, hey, somebody puts in $1 million for 10%, well, the company must be worth $10 million. Well, that's not really the case, because again, that preferred capital raise has different rights and preferences. And if we were to kind of go through all the math here, the value of the company is certainly going to be something less than $10 million. So the common value isn't necessarily equal to the preferred value. And in fact, very rarely is that the case. But I think a lot of times that's a shortcut that people take And I think it probably artificially inflates the common investors' expectations as to what their shares are actually worth. And there was kind of a rule of thumb, and I think it's fallen by the wayside a little bit, but it used to be, hey, if we're raising, you know, preferred at a dollar, normally there was an estimate that, well, the common must be only worth 10% of that. In some cases, that's true. Some cases, it's worth more. Some cases, it's worth less. It's all dependent on the waterfall, which is all company specific. You know, what are the allocations of value and when are those triggers met? But it's very, very company specific, and we need to take in those different rights and preferences into account in order to get to a reasonable value for a business and for the equity. So as we wrap up here, the next couple slides are really just for reference for you, where that AICPA guidance lays out all the different stages of development and where a company falls, and then it talks about, well, what are the valuation methods for each of those stages? What would be applicable? What would we expect to see? And then what sort of discount rates would we expect to see for those companies based on their stage of development? And those discount rates impact the value and the risk of the business when we're applying an income approach and we're looking at the projections of the companies together. So it's no stretch, we'll kind of leave you with this idea that the story and the projections that are really most important for early stage companies, because that's what the investors are going to use to determine the value of the company. And, you know, there's a list of different things here that investors are going to look at, and it's not an all-inclusive list, but those are certainly some of the ideas that, you know, those investors are going to hone in on as far as determining whether they think the projections are reasonable and the sort of risk that they assign to them. So, you know, as we wrap up the hour here, again, you get to drink through the fire hose for 60 minutes as far as the download on how does valuation work, you know, what are the factors that we need to take into account with early stage companies. So hopefully as we wrap up here, you have a little bit more of an understanding as to, you know, how to value a company, what are the methodologies, what's relevant for early stage companies to make you a little bit more dangerous the next time that you encounter those issues in practice. So the last quote, you know, from Mollier, that things only have the value that we give them. Again, just trying to emphasize the fact that, you know, especially with early stage companies, you know, value is very investor specific, and that getting that information in front of as many investors as possible is really the way to try to maximize, you know, the bargaining power of the company and the value that might be offered for it. So Leah, I will turn it over to you to give the group the update on the next presentation.
Absolutely. Just a few things to mention before I talk about what we're going to be speaking on February. In wrapping up this business valuation presentation, you know, please note that we will email out a link to a copy of the recording. Also, we'll send out PDF copies of the slides and the case study that Sean mentioned. Next month, the first Friday of the month falls on the first day of the month. So in Cleveland, we will be doing a live presentation at 8 a.m., and the webinar is the following Monday at 1 p.m. We are talking on intellectual property licensing. This is going to be a business and lawyer kind of matchup where we have a marketing company that goes out and sources new technologies. So going out to earlier stage companies looking for new technology that's, you know, cutting edge for bigger corporations and matching them with an IP attorney that does these type of licensing transactions. So that's what's coming up in February. And, you know, thank you for everyone who stuck on the call for a little bit more than an hour. We really appreciate your time. If you have any questions, if you think of anything, you know, tomorrow, next week, feel free to reach out to us. Our emails are up on the screen. You know, and I reached out to a number of people on LinkedIn, and feel free to send me a LinkedIn message as well. So thank you all, and we'll close down the presentation now.